good Wednesday morning to you. Welcome into the Nick Craig Show, streaming live this morning on YouTube, Rumble, and X. Don't forget that you can take the show with you anytime, any place, anywhere by checking out the podcast. It is available 24/7 wherever you get your shows. Just search for the Nick Craig Show in your favorite podcast app and listen on demand on your own time. Well, a big night in Washington, D.C. last night, and no, we are not talking politics. We're talking UNCW men's basketball as they played number 12th ranked Delaware for the Coastal Athletic Association title. And for the first time since 2017, the UNCW men's basketball team won that tournament and they have punched their ticket to the big dance, the March Madness NCAA men's tournament that will be taking place in Washington, the game last night in Washington, D.C., the March Madness tournament, which begins here starting late next week. This was the trophy celebration as it took place in D.C. last night with the head coach, Takeo Siddle.
Takeo, the journey to this point is never easy. There's ups and downs, and there's a lot of challenges along the way, from preseason to regular season to the tournament. Tonight, you've accomplished and met all those challenges, and you're CAA champions. Congratulations.
A great victory for UNCW, a massive win for the new head coach in Takeo Siddle. He's been there a couple of years. He is a very young coach. And a huge victory last night for the men's basketball team. Congratulations to them. A nail-biter of a game that literally went down to the final seconds with a 76-72 win over Delaware, punching their ticket to the big NCAA tournament. Selection Sunday is this weekend. We'll learn UNCW's rank, probably 13 or 14, and we'll figure out where their first game is going to be played and see what they can do. In regards to the tournament, obviously an uphill battle for a college coming out of the CAA tournament, but nevertheless getting there, a huge victory for UNCW. Congratulations to the men's basketball team, and I'm sure everybody here in Wilmington will be rooting along as that takes place. There was some comments from the MVP last night giving a nice shout out to Wilmington. Let's take a listen to that.
Today at 24, today 17, you were the pulse for this team moving forward and getting to this point. What's going through your mind?
Man, I just love my team, man. They made me a promise about 3-4 months ago. I told them to take me March Madness, and they kept the end of the bargain. So I just love my team, man. I love them, and I love my support team. Shout out to y'all nation, man. Title Town, man. This is for y'all. This is for Wilmington, man. I love Wilmington. Thank you. Thank you so much, man. God put me in a position. He blesses me. He keeps blessing me, man. Thank you so much, man.
Talk about the DNA of all your guys.
A huge victory for UNCW last night. Congratulations to them. We'll be watching them alongside in the March Madness tournament. We'll let you know coming up Monday morning who they're going to be playing and when that game is going to be taking place. Well, on to the news of the day on this Wednesday morning. We start with the Department of Education being led by Linda McMahon. She, under the first Trump administration, the Secretary of the Small Business Administration, now leading the Department of Education, and some major cuts yesterday. More than 1,300 Department of Education staffers were terminated by the new administration yesterday after all employees received an ominous note instructing them to stay home for work. A senior Department of Education official said yesterday, quote, Yesterday, we are beginning the process to cut the total number of staff at the Department of Education roughly in half. As part of the reduction in force process, 1,315 Department of Education employees have been laid off. The official noted that nearly 600 people had already left the department via voluntary measures, such as through the Federal Deferred Resignation Program and a separate directive, a department buyout initiative offered to employees earlier this month. This, of course, as the Trump administration continues to streamline not just the Department of Education, but the federal government as a whole. And, you know, as I was doing research on this last night, the fact that they laid off 1,300 employees, and that's half of their workforce as they're attempting to do that is absolutely remarkable. Why did the Department of Education, why does the Department of Education need close to 3,000 employees? I mean, that is a massive, massive amount of employees to have for an agency and an entity that many argue is not necessary. That it is the Department of Education, many of the things that they are involved in are very easily done, and in many cases are already done by state and local governments. This is exactly when we talk about the bureaucracy that exists at the federal level. This is the kind of stuff that we're talking about. Why does the Department of Education, well, I mean, many questions, why does the Department of Education even exist in its current form? That's, of course, a valid question and concern. But an even bigger question, why are there so many employees? Right? What is the Department of Education accomplishing besides creating levels of bureaucracy and red tape, which is exactly what goes on? Another 63 staffers are on probationary employment with less than a year of served time. They were fired last month, and the official noted, quote, "We are focusing on eliminating full teams whose operations are either redundant or not necessary for the functioning of the department." So you've got individuals that are collecting a federal paycheck through the Department of Education that are either doing redundant work or what they're doing at all is not necessary for the function of the Department of Education. Why does that happen? Why does that even exist in the first place? Employees received termination notices will get 90 days full pay and benefits until they are formally fired and will receive severance pay in the amount of 1 week's salary for every year of service, up to 10 years and 2 weeks' salary for every year beyond 10 years. The official noted, quote, "We're going to have these folks roll over their responsibilities by Friday, March the 21st. They will then go on paid administrative leave until the reduction in the force is complete. They will telework from tomorrow, meaning today, until March the 21st. Then all of that is being done for safety reasons to protect the 2,183 employees that are going to remain after the reduction in force is complete." So even after all of this is said and done, the Department of Education will still have more than 2,100 employees. That is more than enough to deal with what the Department of Education does. The official cited student test scores plummeting despite over $1 trillion in federal spending from the department since its inception as a reason for dramatic cuts. The official said, quote, "We have an incredible leader in Secretary Linda McMahon, who has built a multi-billion dollar global business and has handled restructuring several times before. And all of this is being done with a very careful eye towards making education better, reducing bureaucracy, and empowering the states to take charge of their own decisions." Earlier in the day yesterday, Department of Education staffers in the department's Washington, D.C. office were told their buildings would be closed for security reasons on Wednesday as reports circulated that mass layoffs were imminent. The email says, quote, "Employees will not be permitted in any Department of Ed facility on Wednesday, March 12th for any reason." Last month, of course, you had the situation take place where you had Democrats standing in front of the Department of Education building, screaming about how they deserve and need access and how they demand to get into this building and how it's their constitutional right to do so. It was Maxine Waters and a bunch of other Democrats complaining about why they didn't get access to that building as they continue to throw a tantrum over what's going on at the federal level. And so all of this combined, and when I say all, I was talking about, you know, everything that we've talked about over the last couple of weeks. This is exactly what Trump campaigned on. He talked about shrinking the size of the federal government. He talked about getting the federal bureaucracy in check and under control. I don't know why anybody is shocked by this. I don't know why anybody is mystified as to what's going on this morning. Everybody was very well aware what things were going to look like under the second Trump administration. There is no question about it. And with all of that, being said, I don't understand what the thought was here. I don't know what people were thinking. Maybe they just assumed that Trump was just lying. Maybe individuals just believed and thought, oh, you know, who cares? He's not actually going to follow through on anything. Well, promises made, promises kept. This is what things are going to look like in the near-term future. We are taking a bloated federal government at so many different levels, so many different departments, and we are hacking and slashing it. And I caught this very interesting graphic over at Fox News in regards to the Department of Education, and this kind of says the whole story. Test scores versus education department budget. They had a $76.4 billion budget in 2022 compared to a $68 billion budget 10 years prior in 2012. And look at the results. Age 9 reading down almost 3%. Age 9 math down 4%. Now, I know some of this is, of course, due to the COVID-19 pandemic. A lot of this is due to shutdowns that took place over the last couple of years while Democrats decided that they believed and thought it was a good idea to shut down schools. While Democrats thought it would be good for young individuals' educations to box them out of their classroom, to take children, send them home, and have them learn on Zoom, have them learn on a Microsoft Teams meeting in regards to their education. That was never going to work. There was no reality that existed in which sending children home to learn on Zoom and to shut down and shutter their classrooms for months and years on end would lead to a proficient school system. There was no indication that was ever going to happen. And of course, end result is exactly where we are right now, where test scores have plummeted and have not begun to recover from COVID-19, from the unconstitutional shutdown of businesses, schools, all of the nature. Things need to change. The status quo that has existed in this country under agencies like the Department of Education is not working. You've got individuals, you've got parents that are making radical decisions about what they're doing with their children's educations. And radical doesn't mean things are happening in a bad way. When I say radical, we're not talking about bad decisions. We're talking about major changes. Looking at other sorts of education, whether it be in the state of North Carolina, a charter school, a private school via a voucher program. Right? These decisions and these discussions are taking place at a major national level right now. And they should be. Because turns out, doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result is the quintessential definition of insanity. And so going back to this Fox News chart, $76.4 billion was the Department of Education budget just a couple of years ago. Can that money be better spent by allocating more to states, allocating more to local school districts, and cutting out staff and salaries and bureaucracy in Washington, D.C.? Right, because all the left loves to talk about is education and teacher pay and how Republicans hate schools and this, that, and the other. Right, this is a constant narrative, specifically here in North Carolina. So the question is, I think, a fair one. Can that $76.4 billion be better utilized by cutting out the middleman, cutting out the bureaucracy, cutting out the red tape, and actually putting that money towards, oh, I don't know, education? This is a massive amount of money that we're talking about. And so when the Department of Education says, hey, we're trying to reduce our staff in half, that's what we're cutting our staff by 50%, and we're still going to operate. That's very eye-opening. When a Department of Education official puts out a press release yesterday and says that, hey, we're getting rid of people that are doing redundant work. We're getting rid of people who are not doing anything that is required by the department, and it continues to operate. That should be a huge wake-up call to everybody involved. Because the federal government at this point in time is essentially turned into just a workforce program. It's not about doing a good job for whatever the department is, whether it's EPA, Department of Ed, FEMA, whatever. You can name off every federal agency you'd like. It's just turned into a workforce program where individuals can collect good salaries and good benefits on behalf of the U.S. taxpayer, irregardless of results. Right? We were talking yesterday about the status of the economy. When you spend money on something as a private consumer, you would like to get a good ROI on that. If you pay somebody to come fix your air conditioner, you would hope that the money that you spent leads to your air conditioner working or working more efficiently or working better. If you are paying people to come and fix your air conditioner and it's not being fixed, that's a bad return on your investment. But we don't look at the federal government like that. We say, sure, Department of Education, we'll continue to give you tens of billions of dollars a year to fund public education, which they is not exactly what they do. But we're going to give you all this money to fund public education. And what are we getting as a result? Age 9 reading and math scores are down. And most reading and math scores are down across the board. So when you see that, I think it's a fair question to say and ask, what is going on here? How are we spending this money? And can we do it more efficiently? Can we do it more effectively? And that's what's going on at the Department of Education this morning. And I've heard the president say it, and I think it's probably where we're tracking with all of this. There's many that say that the Department of Education needs to cease to exist. And I don't disagree with that. You look at the goal and where education needs to be happening, where policy needs to be set, it sure as hell isn't Washington, D.C. It needs to be state governments and local governments, aka local board of elections, educations. Not up at Washington, D.C. Not by 6,000 bureaucrats up in the Department of Education building in the District of Columbia. That's not where education is happening. That's not where policy needs to be set. That's not where the most effective use of our dollars are as taxpayers to provide our children with an education is happening. It's just not. And you can't try and prove me wrong. You can't, because the math is literally here. The budget is up 12%. In a decade between 2012 and 2022, and the scores are down. It is ram-packed with bureaucracy and bloat. And it's why you're seeing mass drop-offs from public schools. Because it turns out, not only is all this money being spent, but children aren't getting an education that their parents approve of. So they're looking for alternatives, whether it be homeschooling or private schools. And the state of North Carolina has really championed that. The school voucher program, which was brought in by the General Assembly back a couple of years ago, has been phenomenally successful. That enrollment period, I believe, is either open right now or opens in the next couple of days, where parents can decide, hey, I'm going to get some of my tax dollars back from the state to send my kid to a private school, where they're not going to be indoctrinated by leftist political ideology in the classroom, where they're not going to be sitting through and learning about gender inclusivity and sitting through trans story hour in the school library. Turns out people aren't really a big fan of that. Shocker, I know. Who could have ever imagined that parents would revolt against that? So I think this is a huge win. I think Linda McMahon is perfect for the job, and she's even kind of highlighted, yeah, I might not have a job very long because the department needs to put, I strongly believe the department needs to turn into something similar to what we discussed with FEMA, where they become an agency that does nothing but funnels money to state governments. And those state governments are the ones that are responsible for education. That's the path we need to take. Decentralization of the government. And there's no better way to do it than hacking and slashing in Washington, D.C. and letting local lawmakers, a.k.a. your North Carolina General Assembly or your state legislature, whatever state you're in, make the decisions and figure out what the needs are and how to best fund it. We know with education, one size doesn't fit all. And we sure as hell know that throwing money at the problem does not guarantee, and almost any of the time, does not create better scores and a better learning environment. There's this really wacky idea from the left that the problem with education is there's just not enough money. So we need more. We need to spend more. The math does not back that up. No pun intended. Throwing money at this problem is not the solution. Does it help in some cases? Absolutely. Is money an integral part of it? Yes. But money does not equal a better result. We know that with education. The math is right here. A 12% increase in funding over between 2012 and 2022, and scores have not improved at all. They've declined. So tell me how throwing money at the problem is the solution here. It's not. So big cuts, big changes at the Department of Education. Love to see it. And potentially working towards and moving towards completely disbanding the Department of Ed as it exists right now and turning it into essentially a block grant clearinghouse for school systems across the United States. I look forward to it. Good work there by Linda McMahon and the Trump administration. Bravo to them. Transitioning this morning into some other major news that we are tracking, national news this morning, as Ukraine has at least tentatively agreed to a U.S. proposed ceasefire with Russia. This is as Washington lifts intelligence and military aid holds. The United States will resume sharing intelligence with Ukraine and end its pause on military aid to the Eastern European country after successful talks yesterday in Saudi Arabia. That resulted in Kiev accepting a Washington proposal to enact an immediate interim 30-day ceasefire, the two nations announced in a joint statement on Tuesday. Though Kyiv agreed to the Trump administration's proposal, officials in Moscow were already signaling that the agreement was a non-starter. So there's obviously more that's going to go on here. And the statement reads as follows. Ukraine expressed readiness to accept the U.S. proposal to enact an immediate interim 30-day ceasefire, which can be expanded by mutual agreement of the parties, and which is subject to the acceptance and concurrent implementation by the Russian Federation. The United States will communicate to Russia that Russia reciprocal is key to achieving the process. There was no immediate sign that the Kremlin was on board with this, with Russian State Duma Deputy Viktor Sobelev first on the mark to reject the proposal. He said in a translated statement, quote, "The U.S. will rearm Ukraine in the 30 days of ceasefire and start the war anew. Russia will not go for it." He said, "I think this is completely unacceptable. Some kind of temporary ceasefire, a temporary truce is unacceptable." At the meeting in Saudi Arabia, Kiev proposed two other main lines of efforts which they would agree to with Russia in addition to the ceasefire: the release of prisoners of war and detainees, both military and civilian, and the return of Ukrainian children who were forcibly transferred to Russia. The Ukrainian president Vladimir Zelensky said in a statement on X yesterday afternoon, quote, "The American side understands our agreements and considered our proposal. I am grateful to President Trump for the constructive conversation between our teams." Well, it seems Zelensky learned his lesson. it would appear that he learned that showing his ass and acting like an idiot in front of Trump and trying to stonewall the administration in front of the American press was a pretty stupid idea. This man has changed his tune pretty quickly. Kiev initially offered an air and sea-based ceasefire, but ultimately agreed to the U.S. proposal of a full-blown month-long stop on combat. The Ukrainian president said during today's talk, the U.S. side proposed taking an even bigger first step, a 30-day full interim ceasefire, not only stopping missiles, drones, and bombs attacks, not only in the Black Sea, but also along the entire front line. Ukraine is ready to accept this proposal. We see it as a positive step and are ready to take it. Now it is up to the United States to convince Russia to do the same. If Russia agrees, the ceasefire will take effect immediately. In a joint statement, Washington said it was up to the task, committing to discussing these specific proposals with representatives from Russia. At the White House on Tuesday, President Trump said he expected to talk with Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin later this week about a possible ceasefire, telling reporters it takes two to tango, saying, quote, Ukraine has agreed to it and hopefully Russia will agree to it as well. The Trump proposal involved not only a ceasefire, but a commitment to begin immediate negotiations to end the conflict in a way that's enduring and substantive. That was according to Secretary of State Marco Rubio. So, for the first time in years, dialogue and conversation is happening. What a novel concept. What a bizarre thing to take place. Did you know and were you aware that President Joe Biden had not spoken to the Russian president at all since this war broke out? There was no dialogue between the president of the United States and the president of Russia. Now, of course, the left will take that and they continue with their idea notion that Trump is Vladimir Putin's puppet. Somehow they've concocted that in their heads. Somehow they believe that is taking place and that's true. So they believe that not having any sort of leadership at all in a conflict like this is the solution. And we know where that got us. We have seen over the last couple of years where having no leadership, where ignoring the situation that's going on, ignoring this international conflict doesn't work. Because nobody is going to flat out, quote unquote, win this war. I put that in quotes. Russia should have, if you look at the pure military strength and what they have available, they should have been able to clean up this Ukraine problem. If they wanted to take over all of Ukraine, they should have been able to do that in the matter of weeks. Their military was greatly overestimated, and they have completely stalled. And we have been sitting in a relatively similar position for quite some time now, years. The conflict is not going to solve itself. Somebody is going to have to broker a deal. It sure as hell wasn't Joe Biden. It sure as hell wasn't the Democrats. They did nothing. They had no open lines of communication at all. The only thing they did was give hundreds of billions of dollars to Ukraine and just hope that the problem would go away. Just assume something was going to change. Ukraine never made any sort of big time pushes into Russia. Ukraine was never going to take over all of Russia. Russia was never going to surrender just willingly without some sort of agreement, without some sort of deal. I mean, you don't need to have a PhD in international political science to figure this stuff out. You don't have to be a war scholar to see how this was going to play out based on what's going on over the last couple of years. Yet the previous administration did not even have channels of communication open. Trump promised during the campaign that he would end this war. And literally since day one, he has been working to do so. We could be a couple of weeks closer to this if Zelensky hadn't been such an idiot at the White House back a couple of weeks ago, if he had accepted the mineral deal when he should have and was supposed to, we could already be a couple more weeks down the road. And so now the question is on, what will Russia do? And I strongly suspect that Russia will probably take this ceasefire. Publicly, they're going to say they're not. They're going to probably continue to ramp up the rhetoric publicly. You'll continue to hear leaks from officials in Russia that, oh, we're not taking a ceasefire. This is unacceptable. We're not doing this. We're not doing that. But as I don't know when it's set to happen, it could be today, tomorrow, as Trump communicates with the Russian president, I suspect that behind-the-scenes conversation is going to be very different. So I suspect in the end, and there might have to be some additional changes to it, but I suspect Russia will take this ceasefire. They got way in over their skis on this thing, and there is no way for them to turn back. Russia is not going to win. Russia is not taking over Ukraine. Russia is not getting back the 2014 or 2012 territory that they took over. That's not going to happen. It's just not. They might want it to. The Russian president wants it to, but it's not going to. They've had like 3 years to get this thing solved if they wanted to, and they've miserably failed. Their military showed to be nothing more than a paper tiger. So this is really Russia's only path out of this. Or if not, they can just continue to shoot and kill each other without anybody making any substantial movements at all. So the U.S. is back in the fold. This is obviously good for international conflict. Of course, this is a huge problem for the Democrats who love war, for individuals that want to continue to waste taxpayer dollars funding a conflict that has no substantial impact on the United States in any way, shape, or form. We know that's because a lot of them are receiving kickbacks. We know that there's a lot of shady activity going on in Ukraine with the hundreds of billions of dollars that we have allocated to that country. Half of it apparently not even accounted for inside of Ukraine. These peace talks and deals, these peace talks and the ceasefire deal and an end-all-be-all treaty needs to happen. Because the way things are going right now, they just can't continue. This war will literally never end. It will go on forever. Nobody will win. It'll just be more and more individuals getting slaughtered and killed with nobody gaining anything. The war has been a stalemate for quite some time. So props to Marco Rubio. Props to the Trump administration and props to Ukraine for specifically the president there, Vladimir Zelensky, for having a come to Jesus moment, getting slapped down into reality back a couple of weeks ago and moving forward with what needs to happen, a ceasefire and a peace deal and moving on from this conflict. That's the only path forward. We'll continue to track it right here on the Nick Craig Show. I want to remind you that you can support the show financially and get access to bonus content, including our daily show notes. If you believe that you are getting some value out of the show, I encourage you to head on over to patreon.com/Nick Craig, $5, $10 a month. You can also set a custom amount. You can support the show financially and get access to those daily show notes, as well as our monthly hangout, where we go through and chat about politics a couple of hours each and every month. All of that available over at patreon.com/Nick Craig. On the other side, the House Republicans have worked forward in a step to avert a potential government shutdown. We've got some details on that. Plus, USAID officials are telling their employees to shred paperwork ahead of the imminent shutdown of USAID. We'll have those details coming up. You're listening to The Nick Craig Show, streaming live this morning on YouTube, Rumble, and X, and available 24/7 wherever you get your podcasts. And welcome back to the Nick Craig Show, streaming live this morning on YouTube, Rumble, and X 24/7, wherever you get your podcasts. Things are set to heat up throughout the end of this week as we are facing a government shutdown. Yesterday, it was the House of Representatives, the House Republicans, who passed a federal funding bill that was, in fact, backed by President Donald Trump, largely on their own yesterday afternoon. It also marked one of the rare occasions in recent memory that a majority of House Democrats voted against a bill that would prevent a government shutdown. Boy, shoes on the other foot, isn't it? Right, because it's always the Republicans' fault. You ever notice this when it comes to government shutdowns? Doesn't matter who's in charge. Doesn't matter what party is in power. It's always the Republicans' fault. Democrats will vote against a government shutdown, and they will blame Republicans for it. It's their fault that the government shut down. And I'll just say this. I don't really care if the government shuts down. I mean, like this idea that the American people are going to be just completely in a total state of shock and disrepair if the federal government shuts down. Nobody cares. I mean, is my life going to be substantially affected with a partial government shutdown? The answer is no. People are frustrated with the current form of government. People are frustrated with out-of-control spending in Washington, D.C. And so if the government shuts down, I just kind of shrug my shoulders and say, okay, what's today, Thursday? Yeah, okay, I'm going to have to get up and go to work. Oh, it's a Saturday? Well, I guess I get to sleep in, enjoy my weekend. My life doesn't change. All the core services are still provided. TSA still operates. All of that fun stuff. Who cares? So if Democrats don't want to vote for this, if Democrats think that it's a good idea for them to shut down the government, then I'm in favor of it. I don't particularly care. The bill in the House passed largely along party lines in a 217 to 213 votes. Just one Republican, Thomas Massie, voted against the bill. Not sure what the hell his problem is as of late. And one lone Democrat, Representative Jared Golden out of Maine, joined the rest of the GOP in advancing it. With that, the House is now out of session until March the 24th. They've done their job. The measure, which is a short-term extension of the fiscal year 2024 funding, known as a continuing resolution, now heads to the U.S. Senate. It must pass there to get on Trump's desk before the end of the day on Friday, that's March the 14th, to avert a partial government shutdown. In a major victory for Trump and House GOP leaders, however, several House Republicans who've professed they would never vote for a CR supported the current bill. Amongst them was Representative Eric Burleson out of Missouri, who credited Trump with his decision to barely support the bill. He said the barely is Donald Trump. He is the difference maker. I would never support this language, but I do trust Donald Trump. And so that should not be understated, because you've got these individuals that never want to support a CR. And when rubber meets the road, continuing resolutions are not great. I'm not going to sit here and pretend that a CR is a great thing, that it's the way that government should operate. It shouldn't. We should not constantly be talking about partial government shutdowns and continuing resolutions and stopgap measures to keep the government open. Congress should be able to hammer this stuff out through normal business and get a solution done, but they can't. So the CR is where we are this morning. However, this is a very scaled back, stripped back CR. And, you know, you had another individual, Representative Greg Stubick of Florida, said, quote, "I'll be the first guy to tell you I don't like CRs. I've never voted for one before," but he voted for this one. He said, "But the Democrats aren't going to help us. And the Democrats are just going to put any shutdown on the president, which obviously isn't good for the party. So I think it's important that we give the party, the president, and the conference time to come up with a good budget." Is that not the biggest breath of fresh air that you've ever heard? I find myself continually so frustrated with Republicans and conservatives in Congress. There is nothing wrong with being principled. There is nothing wrong with standing on your morals. But the amount that Republicans are willing to shoot themselves in the foot, to stand on some sort of moral high ground, to champion this, that, or the other, is so frustrating. You guys are in control. You have the White House. You have the House. You have the Senate. Let's stop shooting ourselves in the foot and get things done for the American people. There is no reason that any Republican should have voted against this CR. I don't know what Thomas Massie's problem is. He is against everything that Republicans bring forward. He is, at this point, a do-nothing congressman, a guy that was very influential, a guy that is a very strong conservative, but at this point, he's been nullified to nothing because he's just constantly in the opposition to anything that Republicans want to do. Politics is not a game of getting 100% of what you want 100% of the time. It's not. If you believe that's what politics is, you shouldn't be involved in it. Right? It's a collective body of individuals. Everybody has to get together and everybody has to agree. And when you've got 200 plus individuals in the Republican conference that have to get together, not everybody's going to get what they want. Not every single congressman, not every single principled or moral conservative is going to get 100% of what they think they need or that they want. And so the question is, and you go back to an old Ronald Reagan quote, the old 80-20 friend versus foe. Which, by the way, speaking of Ronald Reagan, a quick tangent here. If you've not watched the Reagan movie that came out, I believe it was last year, you need to. I had the opportunity to watch it over the weekend, and it is a phenomenal depiction of Ronald Reagan. And this is his quote. "The person who agrees with you 80% of the time is a friend and an ally, not a 20% traitor." I'll read that again for you. "The person who agrees with you 80% of the time is a friend and an ally, not a 20% traitor." That needs to be the guiding light, the northern star for Republicans in Washington, D.C. over the next couple of years. And I would argue that this CR is an 80% friend. This is the 80%. And so this idea that there are groups of Republicans that wanted to stonewall this was a terrible idea. And it really goes to show you the influence that Trump has and should have over Republican lawmakers. He wants to get his agenda done. He wants to continue to operate in the manner that he wants to, the effective nature that we've seen over the last 50 some odd days. And the only way he's able to do that is if Congress gets on board. We saw during the first Trump administration that for the first couple of years, Congress was not on board. You had House Speaker Paul Ryan, who was as much against Trump as Democrats, refused to work with the president, thought that he had all the power, thought that he had all the bargaining chips. And it caused the Trump administration, the first administration, to be highly ineffective in a lot of things because there was constant stonewalling from people within his own party. That attitude, that agenda, that tone has shifted dramatically in the second Trump term, and for good reason. And so that's the situation that's unfolding in D.C. right now. Despite passing the House, the legislation is still likely to see an uphill battle in the Senate. At least one Republican there, Senator Rand Paul out of Kentucky, has said that he will not vote for the bill. Republicans will likely need the help as many as 8 Democrats to meet the upper chamber's 60-vote threshold. The bill includes an additional $8 billion in defense and an apparent bid to ease national security hawk concerns, while non-defense spending that Congress annually appropriates would decrease by about $13 billion. There's also another wish list item from the White House, $6 billion for health care for veterans. The White House has requested additional spending in areas that were not present in the latest government funding extension, known as anomalies. Among the anomalies are some added funding to women, infant, and child federal benefits programs, WIC, and nearly $1 billion in aid to immigration and customs enforcement deportation efforts. There is also some added funding for defense in there as well. So we talked about some of those details yesterday with the continuing resolution. So now the question is, what do Democrats in the Senate want to do? Do they want to shut down the government. It's going to be an interesting thing to play out over the next 2 days. Republicans seems like all of them but one in Rand Paul will be voting in favor of this in the Senate. So that puts the cards and the chips in the Democrats' hand. What do they want to do? And as I said earlier, I'm okay with the government shutdown. I'm not going to lose any sleep. My life is not going to be altered. I'm not going to be crying at night and attempting to go to bed because there's a partial government shutdown. As I noted, I don't particularly care. I'm sure many of you fall in the same boat. And so what do Senate Democrats do? It's going to be really hard for them to try and spin the narrative up that it's the Republicans' fault that the government's shutting down. Trump is in favor of this CR. Again, not perfect, better than a partial shutdown. Trump's in favor of the CR. House Republicans are in favor of the CR. They advanced it. Senate Republicans are in favor of the CR. So, Democrats, what is your next move? What is your next play? You're not going to be able to gin up and spin up the media narrative that it's Trump's fault that the government shut down. If 8 Democrats are not willing to cross the aisle, the government will shut down, and that's totally fine. I don't care. And I'm not even sure Trump cares, if I'm being perfectly honest. All of the power lays here in Senate Democrats. What do they want to do? I don't particularly care. If they're smart, especially some potential Senate Democrats that are up for re-election in 2026, they'll vote for this. They will stand alongside the Republicans. You know, it's always funny. I'll remind you, how many times do you hear from the left about coming together, compromising, working in a bipartisan manner, Republicans and Democrats, we need to erase the political divide and come together. Here's your freaking golden opportunity to do it. If you guys truly care about and want to practice what you preach. I, of course, saying that a little bit tongue in cheek, the reality is Democrats don't want to work across the aisle. Democrats don't want to see political lines erased. They're hyper-partisan. They want to get all of their concessions. They want to get all of their wish list items. That's all they care about. They're not interested in working across the aisle. They're not interested in that. They can preach that on cable news. They can go on MSNBC and talk about it, but they're going to have an opportunity over the next 2 days to prove if that's the case. So going to be very interesting to watch the ongoings of the U.S. Senate. I'll keep an eye on it, and we'll pass details along right here on the Nick Craig Show. Before we get to USAID and shredding and burning paperwork, this was a very interesting committee hearing yesterday that took place in Washington, D.C. Representative Keith Self called Democrat Representative Sarah McBride, Mr. Sarah McBride is the representative that sparked all of the controversy over men and women's bathrooms at the congressional level, at the federal level over the last couple of months. Watch this clip as it played out in Washington, D.C. yesterday. Pretty laughable.
I now recognize the representative from Delaware, Mr. McBride.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ranking Member Keating, also wonderful.
Mr. Chairman, could you repeat your introduction again, please?
Yes, we have set the standard on the floor of the House, and I'm simply...
What is that standard, Mr. Chairman? Would you repeat what you just said when you introduced a duly elected representative from the United States of America, please?
I will. The representative from Delaware, Mr. McBride.
Mr. Chairman, you are out of order. Mr. Chairman, have you no decency? I've come to know you a little bit, but this is not decent.
We will continue this.
You will not continue it with me unless you introduce a duly elected representative the right way.
This hearing is adjourned.
Okay. So you've got a man pretending to be a woman, Representative Sarah McBride, who's pretending to, is not a woman, is a man, pretending to be a woman. The head of this committee, Representative Keith Self, says the representative will be recognized, Mr. McBride, and other Democrats fly off the handle. It's insane. It's This is what the left wants to argue over. This is how the Democrats, I guess, want to go down in the history books. Don't play their games. I mean, this is really as simple as it is. We are not playing, and we are done playing the games of the left. If you're a man, you're going to be referred to as a man. If you're a woman, you're going to be referred to as a woman. This garbage, this nonsense is over with. We are no longer capitulating and bowing down to the left. I know I've been saying this a lot, and some of you are probably sick of me hearing it, but we're in charge now. You guys don't get to set the game rules anymore. You guys don't get to determine how things are done. You had your chance to do that, and you were unable to convince the American people that it was the best and the biggest and best way forward. You were unsuccessful in convincing the American public of that in the election in November. Do you have no decency, Mr. Chairman? Who cares? Misgendering? I mean, this is the argument that we're having at the federal level right now? Guys, this stuff is not popular. You guys are, the Democrats, you guys are completely off base with this stuff. You have lost the public opinion on it. And so these stupid little outbursts and this, no, you have no decency, I will not sit here. Okay, then don't sit here. The meeting is adjourned. Then great, we don't have a committee meeting. Here's the thing you guys may not understand. We don't care anymore. The time of pandering and capitulating and bowing down to the left with all of their stupid, radical, crazy BS is over. The American people very clearly in November decided that these political games were done. They're sick of it. They don't want to play the game anymore. You guys made the rules so freaking crazy that nobody wants to partake. It's not fun anymore. It's just not. Nobody cares. The mass outrage, we're over it. Move on. Have your freaking committee meeting and get over it. Nobody cares. I mean, I don't know any other way to put it. Nobody freaking cares. You're not properly announcing a duly elected member of Congress. Okay. Spare me your outrage. Spare me the controversy. I'm over it. You guys have extended played out all of your goodwill on this stuff. Nobody cares. Nobody's going to play your stupid games anymore. I'm sorry, but we're not. We're just not. It's over. I thought that was a pretty rich coming out of Congress yesterday. I'll throw the full link up on the show notes over at patreon.com/Nick Craig. Here's an interesting headline from Politico this morning. USAID officials tell staffers to shred and burn documents. Wow, that's illegal, is it not? The U.S. Agency for International Development, officials there telling people to shred and burn federal documents? Shred and burn federal paperwork? The hell are these people thinking? A senior official at USAID instructed a number of agency's remaining staff to convene at their now former headquarters in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday for an all-day group effort to destroy documents stored there, many of which contain sensitive information. Is this not just the quintessential example of the fraud that was taking place within USAID? They're literally shredding and burning sensitive documents. Why? Because it's going to show the sham, show all of the fraud, all of the kickback to Democrats that were happening within this organization. Why would you be shredding documents if USAID was this above board operation? This above board entity that's not doing anything shady. It's not pissing away billions of dollars worth of taxpayer money a year. If none of that was happening, why would you be shredding documents? The materials earmarked for destruction include consents of the agency's classified safe and personnel documents at the Ronald Reagan Building, said in an email sent by USAID's acting executive director, Erica Carr, that was obtained by Politico. The email reads as follows. Shred as many documents first and reserve the burn bags for when the shredders become unavailable or need a break. As she instructed staff to label the burn bags with the words secret and USAID. The email did not provide any reason for the document destruction. The building is currently in the process of being emptied out after mass layoffs, which may have disrupted routine document destruction timetables. Customs and Border Protection is planning to move into the USAID facility, having rented the 390,000 square foot office space last month. The effort also underscores the way in which the Trump administration is dismantling the agency that once managed a $40 billion a year annual budget and had more than 10,000 staffers across the country. Wow. Burning and shredding documents? Now, here's the good news. Most of these documents still likely exist on classified computer systems. One of the benefits of the technological era that we're in is that physical paperwork, right? Like, you know, physical documents that have pertinent information, a lot of that stuff is no longer relevant. All of the vast majorities of the communication that's happening are happening via email, happening via messaging platforms and services like Slack or Teams, and all of that stuff is traceable. All of that stuff has got backups and is stored within the federal government. We have access to that information. So this idea that the USAID is going to shred and burn all of the sensitive information that might show and likely shows the wrongdoings, the fraud, the waste, the abuse that was going on within this entity is ridiculous. I mean, if that's what they want to do to try and cover their, to play a little bit of CYA, I guess more power to them. But let's be clear and honest. If, in fact, there was mass amounts of fraud, which I believe there's evidence to prove, if there was mass amounts of fraud that existed within USAID, it's going to be brought forward. It's going to come up. And shredding documents is not going to admonish anybody's culpability in what went on. It is not going to wipe the slate clean. People should go to jail. With the amount of waste, with the amount of fraud, with the amount of abuse that went on in agencies like USAID, people need to be held accountable. And when I'm not talking about throwing rank and file people in prison, but individuals that allowed this to go on at the highest levels of this entity, of this agency, they need to be held to account. If I commit fraud as a private citizen, bank fraud, whatever kind of fraud, if I'm cashing checks that aren't in my name, if I'm stealing somebody's identity and using their debit or their credit card, I go to jail. It's fraud. It's illegal. I am held responsible by that, by legal penalties, restitution, and likely jail time. Why would it be any different for USAID? Why would it be any different for any other federal agency? If they're committing fraud, if they're partaking in fraud, then somebody needs to be arrested. Somebody, many people, need to go to jail. A spokesperson for the White House in Anna Kelly downplayed the concerns in a post on social media late yesterday, saying, quote, "This email was sent to roughly 36 employees. The documents involved were old and mostly courtesy content, which is content from other agencies, and the originals still exist on classified computer system. More fake news hysteria." A former USAID staffer confirmed the email and described the destruction of agency documents as unprecedented. The former staffer, who spoke anonymously to Politico, said this, quote, "I've never seen something like this in mass. Everyone with a safe is supposed to keep it up to date and destroy documents when they no longer need to be stored. Sometimes security will check your safe and tell you if you need to clean out old material." USAID has been the epicenter of Trump and Elon Musk's vision of a smaller federal workforce, with most of USAID's personnel being laid off or placed on administrative leave. So what's the solution? Burn documents and shred them. I'm very curious here, depending on what comes out of this, the acting executive director, Erica Carr, maybe she needs to be brought up on some charges. Don't really know what to make of that. Is this truly a nothing burger? Is there really nothing to see here? Or is USAID, these individuals, are they attempting to continue to elude the federal government, to continue to try and get away with the scam that they've been perpetrating? I don't truly know what to make of it, but I can promise you this, we'll find out. There's no question about it. An investigation will be opened. This will be looked into. I saw some discussion. I don't know if it was ever corroborated on social media, but it seemed like that Pam Bondi was potentially looking into possible arrests and criminal charges after this came out yesterday. USAID shredding and burning documents. What do you have to hide? If this agency is so above board, what are you guys shredding documents for? What are you trying to hide away from the American people? It's a fair and valid question to ask, and we'll see what comes of that over the next couple of days. Well, tonight is a busy night across the state of North Carolina. Democrat Governor Josh Stein is set to give his State of the State address. That will be taking place at 7 p.m. this evening over on PBS North Carolina. You can watch it live on PBSNC, and I will have a full recap, full coverage of that coming up for you tomorrow morning right here on the Nick Craig Show. Want to remind you that if you'd like to get some bonus content, including our daily show notes, you can do so by visiting patreon.com/Nick Craig and support the show. That's going to do it for a Wednesday edition. Thanks for joining us. A full recap on North Carolina's State of the State coming up for you tomorrow on a Thursday edition of the Nick Craig Show. Have a great day.